Accession number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, Rio 14. Now, you were just saying you used to go back to, you were based at Japan.
It was in Sasebo. S-A-S-E-B-O, Sasebo. It's a very, very big harbour and all the American fleets.
And what were you doing there?
Just going ashore and having a booze up and shopping and something.
And had things changed much since you'd last been in, you know?
Well, it was a den of iniquity, Sasebo, because basically, because all the Americans, and all the Allies, I mean, there was, out in Korea, I mean, you had Australian ships, New Zealand ships, Dutch ships, you know, sort of, all sorts of nationalities there. Obviously, there was lots of racketeers going on. Japanese racketeers moved in. Japanese prostitutes from all over the country moved over because it was, you know, it was a den of iniquity, really, compared with the rest of the places. But obviously, highly enjoyed by the services.
So, did anything happen while you were off Korea or off Japan?
Nothing spectacular. I mean, our aircraft did a good job. I mean, the Americans were quite amazed because we used to have what the fly CAPS, combat air patrol. We used to have three of our aircraft flying in a sector, and what used to happen, the army down below, if they got held up by, you know, sort of tanks in a barn or something, or, you know, sort of, they would signal the captain. The Americans had caps, but they used to have more in their cap than ours in different areas. What the Americans said they couldn't understand was when the army called up for support, the Yanks used to go down in one, you know, send the lot down, fire everything they had. Whereas when we had our three caps flying, and we was told this when we was ashore in Sasebo with the Americans, couldn't understand it. The leader of the cap would send one plane down, he'd fire one rocket and blow up the barn or whatever it was that was, you know, with the guns in. And he remarked to one of our people, you know, why do you only fire one rocket? And he said, we can't afford more. But that was where I got an eye-opener. Our country's come the same again. I got friendly with this American chief writer, and he was, I think, editor on the services newspaper in Japan, like for the, and he used to pull these cigarettes out of his pocket, take a cigarette out and light it and put the cigarettes back in his pocket. And I said to him one day, I said, you know, Americans are always renowned for being generous. I said, you're so mean. I didn't smoke cigarettes. I was just, you know, sort of questioning it. I said, you never offer your cigarettes around. He said, you don't. He said, because you never know what's in them. He said, if you buy your own pack, it's got the government seal on it, and you break that pack, you know you're smoking a genuine cigarette. You never take a cigarette off someone that's offered to you. And our country's got much the same now. We've followed suit, sort of thing. Sort of. And the other thing he used to do, he never used to leave any beer in his glass on the bar when he went to the toilet. And I mentioned this. He said, oh, someone could drop something in it. You know, drugs. You know, at the time, I thought it was a horrifying sort of situation, but a lot of that goes on in this country now.
So what's the next thing you remember?
Well, we were going home. I came offshore.
So not a lot happened?
No, I don't. I mean, because from our point of view, it's, you know, you don't see what's going on. The aircraft go off, do their job, come back, that sort of thing.
The ship wasn't attacked at all?
No, no. I mean, from the Navy's point of view, especially on an aircraft car, I mean, they basically had no aircraft. I mean, it was only the flying crews that sort of saw any action, really.
Now, did the ship sail back in August 51, or just you, or did you?
What happened was the night before we were due to go home, I'd been ashore in Sasebo, and when I came back aboard, I went up to the wireless office, as I say, which would normally be the chief's job, just to see everything was all right before I went and turned in. And it was pointed out by the PO of the watch, this signal, that said they were going to make a landing behind the North Korean lines, and they wanted a petty officer telegraphist radio to go. So I went straight down the signal officer's cabin and said, I volunteer to go ashore. He said, but we're going home. I said, I know. And he turned around to me and said, you really must hate this ship. I said, yes, sir, because I told him how I felt about it a long time ago. And he said, you know, want to go ashore on a landing when you could be going home? And I said, yes. It never materialised because evidently the communists had made a sudden advance and you know, those plans went by the board, so I ended up going home.
Anything happened on the way back?
No, nothing spectacular, just, you know, calling the normal ports on the way home.
And then, so you got back round about, looks like August 51, yeah. And then you seem to have spent this Mercury period, yeah. From
well,
August to...
What
to
I did, one way to get off the ship, I, as my other attempt had failed, I volunteered to do a wireless instructor's course. And I was recommended for it, so I went ashore to Mercury and I did a 6 months wireless instructor's course, passed for a wireless instructor.
Now, is there anything to tell us about that? I mean, was there anything new is what we're on about?
No, it's just a normal wireless instructor's course.
And that was at Signal School, HMS Mercury?
HMS Mercury.
And that took, you seem to have been there until February 52, so that's 6 months, yeah.
Well, at the end of the course, a signal came out from Admiralty asking for volunteers for the British North Greenland expedition. They wanted two radio operators for the British...
Now, what's this indomitable thing that comes before that? Is that anything important, or...?
Well, no, it doesn't come before that, because the signal came out before I went to indomitable. The signal came out asking for volunteers, and what happened was I joined the Indomitable. Then I had to go on. Evidently, I was shortlisted, obviously recommended by a captain of the Signal Squad. I was shortlisted.
Now, tell me about why had you volunteered? Tell us what this was you were volunteering for. Sorry, I interrupted you. I put you wrong. So what was it you were going on? It was a British North Greenland expedition.
Yeah.
What made you volunteer for that?
Something I hadn't done before, and once in a lifetime opportunity, never comes around to everybody in a lifetime. And I thought it would be a new experience. And I joined Indomitable, and then I had to do three interviews at different times. One was with the leader of the expedition, Commander C.J.W. Simpson. C.J.W. he was an electrical officer in the Navy, but he was a member of the Royal Naval Mountaineering Association and keen on Arctic exploration, actually. And I had an interview with him, and the man that was going to be the signal officer of the expedition, a Captain John Agar, Royal Signals. Then I had an interview with Dr. Lancelot Fleming, the Bishop of Portsmouth. He was an ex-Antarctic explorer, and he was on the committee.
Now, what were these interviews about? What were they trying to find out?
Well, basically, the first one with the commander, the signal officer, when I boiled it down, really, they didn't really go much into my professionalism because they knew my qualifications. So when you've brought it down, you say they're more interested in your psyche, because people can't always stand being, you know, 24 hours of darkness in the Arctic winters and cramped together in tents and all that sort of thing. Although they're interested in your personality a great deal, and they did ask a few technical questions, obviously, but you know, normally they know you qualifications. Then the next interview was the Bishop of Portsmouth, Dr. Lancelot Fleming.
Now, what was he asking?
Now, the interesting thing here, he was a bachelor. It was a beautiful, hot summer's day in his place in Fareham, at a beautiful place in Fareham. His secretary, Miss... I can't remember, Miss Dax, I think, or Miss Dax, something like that. She was sat on the veranda outside in the sunshine, typing away, and he was interviewing different people, calling, coming in, and I was sat chatting to her for a while. And then I go into his study, beautiful oak-lined study, thousands of books, etc., etc. And here we have, and he turned around to me, and there's a lot of empty cups and saucers on his desk and a coffee pot. And he turned around to me and said, "Would you like a cup of coffee?" And I said, "Yes, please, sir." And he said, "Oh dear," he said, I haven't got a clean cup. And quick as a flash, I thought, my Lord Bishop, he's got a housekeeper, he's got a secretary, and this is a test. So I saw, that doesn't matter, so I said, you know. And he got one of these cups and sort of poured the coffee in it, because I realised that was a test, because he'd been an Antarctic explorer himself. And when you're sledging, you have porridge in the morning and pemmican in the evening, and you lick your plate dry and then just put it back and you get somebody else's plate. So he knew the sort of setup, so he didn't want anybody sort of fussy. and then he had a long chat, obviously interviewing you, sort of also interested in your makeup and what you'd done and what you hadn't done, that sort of thing. And then I had to have a medical at Admiralty at Whitehall Mansions, obviously to make sure I was 100% fit. And from that medical, I had to go up to Cambridge. And because I kept leaving this Indomitable, every time she put in port, I was going on these interviews. Dr. Wordy, I think it was John Wordy, Master John, well, it'd been Dr. Wordy, I might get
him
wrong.
We don't know him.
Yeah,
right.
Dr. Wordy, Master St. John's College at Cambridge. He was an ex-Antarctic explorer. And he'd also been on many polar expedition committees, so he was very experienced. And because I got delayed on this medical in London, so I was a bit late for my interview in Cambridge. And I got there and he said, "Well, jump in the car," he said. "We'll do the interview at home because the wife and I are going to the theatre tonight and got to get home." And went into his study at home, and I remember, because he more or less was interested in education being the Master St. John's College, and he started asking questions nice about my schooling. And when I said I left school at 14, he says, "Well, you didn't have much education then." And I said, "Well, we do have school teachers in the Navy." And I said, "We do learn that." And I always remember saying to him, "Where's your students learn their geography from a book? I've been there," just like that. And he laughed, you see. God, look at that. And then he dropped me back. Yeah, when he went to the theatre, on the way to the theatre, he dropped me back at the station. And then I went back to the Indomitable again. They'd hardly ever seen me in the short period I was on there. And I would like to repeat over the air what my officer said. He said, "Congratulations and something new."
So you left the Indomitable. Now, tell us about the expedition. What was the purpose of the expedition?
Scientific.
In what way, though?
Seismic survey. Meteorological. Oh, what's the other name? Physiological. Physiological, because we had two doctors. And one was a physiologist, so it was, you know, checking. You know, we used to do all sorts of tests and blood tests and things and fat thickness tests, everything else, diet test, measuring your liquid and solid intake and outtake.
So besides being a wireless operator, you were also one of the ones who have been experimenting on.
And I met an observer. I was given a brief running through, so when the meteorological officer wasn't there, I was taking met observations and coding them up and sending them up, because all met observations are coded up. Then, you know, it's not a secret code, it's just a met code to send them so they go all around the world.
So you were trained in that as well?
Yeah. Well, you know, he just told me what to do. All the tricks of, you know, sort of trying to estimate the height of the cloud and that sort of thing, and what type of cloud. I had a book with pictures of different types of cloud in, and
so it was just observational rather than.
I'm trying to think of the survey where they
geological.
It's a geophysical survey. When they test, they had a very scientific instrument with a spring on tested the sort of gravity. Gravimetric survey, got it. Gravimetric survey, yeah.
I don't know, yeah.
Yeah. It was a seismic survey, a gravimetric survey. Geologists, glaciologists, meteorology, and of course also on the medical side, and this started off...
Now, what was the composition of the expedition? Who was on it?
Well, the leader was Commander Simpson. What had happened, Commander Simpson, he was at Admiralty, and he'd indicated that the Navy had always been forefront in polar exploration, and he'd got sort of summary Admiralty approval to think about a polar expedition. But, you know, they couldn't envisage it just yet. They couldn't afford it, and that sort of thing. And he was invited by the leader of the Danish Purulan expedition when they were being resupplied up in Greenland to join them on a flight to go up. So he was given permission by the Admiralty. He went via Denmark and flew up. When he was flying over Queen Louise Land, which is in the north east part of Greenland, very mountainous area, he asked them what this place was, and they said it's Queen Louise Land, named after one of our queens. He said there's not much known about it, and of course that was something straight away in Commander Simpson's ears, and it's not well mapped on the charts, that sort of thing. And he noticed a lake, and he thought the lake's got to be unfrozen because, you know, by the glimmer on the water. So he checked on that, and they said, oh, I believe there was a lake there, this and that. Well, it turned out this lake can be free of ice for about 1 month in a year. So he envisaged, this was right by near the Storstrømmen Glacier, and another glacier, which we ourselves named, which hadn't been named before, called the Unicorn Glacier. So the idea being that he put all this together. Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Algernon Willis, was the president of our committee. And I say we had all these other people like Dr. Worley, Dr. Lancelot Fleming. And
so that's the origins of the expedition. But who was going?
Now, on the expedition itself was Commander Simpson, the leader, Richard Hamilton, who was the chief scientist. He was a meteorologist, met forecast at Prestwick Airport, but he had been on a couple of other polar expeditions. Very knowledgeable man. Very nice man.
Who else? Or what other types of people?
There was Captain Royal Signals, Captain Royal Engineers, two Army Star Sergeants, vehicle artificers, two Merchant Navy Chief Officers from Shell Mix Fleet. Yeah, they were both qualified Master Mariners, but they were Chief Officers, because they were experts on story. And because Shell was big backers of the expedition as well. A scientist, you know, there was two geologists, two glaciologists, a naval officer meteorologist, another naval officer from the Survey Navy, a Danish Army captain as a surveyor, Lieutenant Angus Erskine, he was responsible for dogs, everything else. Lieutenant Commander Brett Knowles, he was a boffin. He had been a Navy flyer. He was a gliding instructor, and he was an electronics boffin. He'd done a lot of electronic research on radar and other things in the war. He was a explosives expert. He was a typical boffin. In actual fact, in the second year, he took over as signal officer. He's a ham radio man. He lives down in Emsworth, near Emsworth. Still keep in touch. Who else? I think that's about.
How many ratings?
A couple of seismologists. That was George Cadd, seismologist. Oh, no ratings.
No ratings.
Well, just two. Myself, Petty Officer Telegraphist, and Dixie Dean, who was a chief radio mechanic. He'd been an ex-Petty Officer Telegraphist and converted to a chief radio mechanic. So, you know, he was an operator.
Now, what planning did you have, or was there none as far as you were concerned, or what preparations?
Well, the signal officer, John Agar, he did all the planning for our equipment, and absolutely brilliant.
John Agar.
A-G-A-R. He was killed in a motor accident about a month ago. Lived down in Bath. He retired as a colonel. He did an absolute brilliant job. I mean, when you can see he'd never been on a polar expedition, and I don't think he failed to think of anything. Everybody in the expedition who wanted something come to the radio people, because we had it all. Old John had everything in the way of spares, tools, you name it, we had it. Radio equipment, everything. Obviously a great administrator and a great organiser was John.
What was he like as a bloke? Because he'd be the one who dealt with you most of all, I presume.
Oh, yes. And since Joan's met him, she's the one person she absolutely idolised him. She was very, very upset when he died. He was absolutely one of nature's gentlemen.
So he did the planning. Was there any...
That was for our side.
For your side, yeah.
I mean, obviously, all the other people did the planning for their own side. We had...
And what kind of preparations were there?
Well, I mean, this is all going on before I was even interviewed. I mean, preparations. I mean, that's all been done by others. When I joined, our main job was the two radio men and John Agar. We were down in the docks. And the main thing with expeditions is the weight. You've got to keep weight down. Well, all our equipment is normally got tropical packing, you know, well packed. And we had to risk certain percentage losses by unpacking it. Also, we sat there for day after day after day unpacking all the bits of equipment and just put it in boxes without any packing, having to risk losses just to keep the weight down. This was all going on a ship called the Totten.
How do you spell it? T-O-T-O?
Yeah, T-O-T-T-A-N. Motor Vessel Totten, MV Totten.
T-O-T-T-A-N.
Yeah. She's a Norwegian sealer. But she was used basically by the Norwegians. She was hired out to supply people in the Arctic, Antarctic. We had sorting all the gear out. Of course, then I was going to go to the ice cap first. Dixie Dean would be in the base. I'd go on the ice cap first. So I...
Hang on. How did he get out there? How did the Totten get out there?
What do you mean, get out there? She's a ship.
She was already there.
No, well, she sailed from England with all her stores once the expedition was organised.
Right. Yeah. So you didn't go aboard her?
Not till she's all loaded up, ready to go, yeah. I had to go to Old Sarum with the army people, because they were doing the airdrop stuff, organising it, because a lot of stuff had to be airdropped when we got to the ice cap. So, sort of making sure they were the experts on packing and organising it, but I was having to make sure that the stuff we wanted would come down in the first load and the second load and the third load, that sort of thing. So I stayed at Old Sarum for a couple of days while that was all going on and sort of sorting that lot out. Once we were due to start, the Totten came into Tower Pier in London. She was alongside, having been all loaded up. And
Was she an HMS or not?
No, she was a Norwegian sealer.
She's still Norwegian.
Norwegian sealer. Norwegian crew captain was about 70, I think. Knew the Arctic and Antarctic. Fantastic men. As usual, one Scotsman on board amongst all the Norwegians. There's always a Scotsman everywhere you go. We had to meet the Queen, Tower Pier. She came down onto the ship. The Bishop of Portsmouth conducted a service for the expedition. And then on the actual jetty at Tower Pier, we had laid out all sorts of our equipment, sledges, and we all had to dress up in our Arctic clothing. You know, we all stood there in a row, and so with all this other equipment, you see, there was special boxes with the sledging rations in. They just fit across the width of a Nansen sledge. And remember the Queen walking along the rank, and I'm at the end of the line, and she chatted to me. a bit as did the others. And she said to me, she said, well, it was a scorching hot summer's day. And I put my foot in it, I think, because she said, you must be very hot in that clothing. And I said, not at all, ma'am. We've got nothing on underneath. So that was that. Now, I didn't sail on the Totten. I was still waiting with some special radio crystals to be cut for the certain frequencies we wanted. So although the other sailed on the Totten, and she was going up to the west coast of Greenland to pick up the dogs. Now, Angus Erskine, the naval lieutenant who was overall responsible for all the dog teams, he'd gone up to the west coast of Greenland with a Danish trapper who was married to a, well, they call them Greenlanders. I mean, they're not Eskimos anymore. The Danes call them Greenlanders. But, yeah, we would call an Eskimo woman. And they'd lived with the Eskimos, for want of a better word, for some time, buying the dogs off, and while the Eskimos taught them, you know, their language for the orders for the dogs.
Hang on, so you'd stayed behind?
Yeah. I was behind with Jim Simpson, the leader, Ron Morton, one of the master mariners, or first officers, Richard Brooks, lieutenant, Survey Navy, and myself, for various reasons they were going late. And we went by train to Pembroke Dock, and we stopped overnight with the RAF, and we flew up to Reykjavik. This was a bit later because the Totten already sailed, and as I say, she went up the west coast of Greenland and then come back to Reykjavik, and we were going to meet her there. But we got there before her, in actual fact, so I had a few days in Reykjavik before she got there. Now,
and so, what month would that be? You joined her at the Totten again at Reykjavik? Or you don't know about that? Look that up. There's books about this.
Yeah, it's all in the books.
So you rejoined them in Reykjavik?
Well, the interesting thing was when we got to Pembroke Dock, the other three were officers. I was a petty officer. And we signed the visitor's book. And I said, I can't come in there with you. It's the wardroom. It's the officer's mess, you see. And Richard Brooks, the lieutenant in the Survey Navy, said, don't put P.O. as your rank, which is petty officer. Put P/O. He said, they'll think you're a pilot officer. So I did. I put P/O, because we're all in civilians, and stayed there overnight and had a nice breakfast with them. And then we flew from Pembroke Dock up to Reykjavik. And in the summer, evidently, in Reykjavik, the hotel in Reykjavik, the University of Reykjavik, all the students on summer leave, and becomes the Gardur Hotel. And a lot of the students earn their money by sort of, you know, being, you know, making beds, cleaning cabins, working in the bar, that sort of. We stopped in the Gardur Hotel.